The topic that I wanted to talk about this morning was a sort of subtlety of training with karmic consequence, the subtlety of training with the law of karma. And I think I could probably sum it up by saying having a trusting attitude when receiving karmic consequence. And that trusting attitude is to trust that kind of, it's along the lines of taking whatever happens to us for our own good. And having a trusting attitude that the things that are arising in our life, in our mind, in our hearts, is the consequence of some past action, and that there's a just reason for it to arise, and trusting that we are able to train through it, that we are able to train with it and to learn something from it and make use of it, even if it's unpleasant. And this trusting attitude is kind of central to that, in the sense that the trusting attitude that I'm thinking of keeps us from getting all defensive about a situation and trying to externalize it and to fix blame outside of ourselves. And as I talk this morning, I'll try to expand on that idea a little bit. And there's a story that came to mind in this book called The Disciples of the Buddha, which I think illustrates what I'm talking about in a kind of nice way. And so I'll read the story and then we'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by this kind of trusting attitude. This is a little booklet, a little book of stories about the chief disciples of the Buddha and a number of other disciples that are kind of helpful in terms of training. And interestingly, it's edited by a Japanese man, and I think he might well be a Zen practitioner, but he is Japanese, and so in that sense is coming at it from a Mahayana point of view. Many of the books that are about the disciples of the Buddha are written from a sort of Theravadan point of view, which is fine. It just is a slightly different way of looking at things than the Mahayana point of view. So I particularly like this collection because it does have a more Mahayana kind of cast to it, a more expanded kind of cast to it, tone to it. And so anyway, I quite like the book. So this is a story about Dabba. The chapter is called Dabba, the servant of the Sangha. The Theragatha contains the following passage as described to a monk named... The Theragatha contains the following passage ascribed to a monk named Dabba Maliputta. Dabba, who is hard to tame but is now tamed by self-taming, is content. With doubts overcome, victorious, with fears truly gone, because Dabba has attained perfect tranquility. The Theragatha, if you don't know, is a collection of really poetry that exists in the Pali Canon, the early Buddhist scriptures, and it's poetry of the Arahant disciples of the Buddha, and has verses about their realization and about their training and practice. Thera, T-H-E-R-A, means elder, and Gatha means verse. And so there's the Theragatha, are the verses of the elders of the Buddha in the Buddha's disciples. There's also a collection of verses called the Therigatha, T-H-E-R-I-G-A-T-H-E-T-H-A. Teri is the female version of elder, so it's the verses of the female Arahant disciples of the Buddha. And that's also quite nice to read, and you'll kind of run across it every now and then, verses from there every now and then. So this verse attributed to Dabba is in the Theragatha. Daba was a monk who voluntarily undertook to perform the various services needed by the other members of the Sangha. He cleaned their rooms, prepared their bedding, and served their meals. Often, he was the victim of misunderstanding, resentment, and even false accusations by the other monks. Daba is said to have recited the words quoted above after one such misunderstanding was resolved. Daba was born into a princely family in the kingdom of Mala, near the Shakya domain, where Shakyamuni was born. When Daba was 7, Shakyamuni went to Mala to preach. Daba's grandmother, a deeply religious woman, who had reared the boy ever since his mother's death, shortly after he was born, took him to hear the Buddha. Shakyamuni seemed a splendid person to the young boy. Daba felt as if he were enfolded in a gentle radiance emanating from the Buddha. He felt as calm and safe as if his mother held him in her arms once again. "Buddha is the most noble of men," his grandmother told him. He left his home, gave up his princely rank, devoted himself to religious practice, and finally attained enlightenment in order to save those who suffer in this earthly life. Her words made a strong impression on Daba. "I want to become like him. I'd like to follow him," he thought. Perhaps because he had lost his mother so early, Daba found that his desire to be with the Buddha grew stronger day by day and year by year. Finally, at the age of 14, with his family's consent, he was admitted to the Sangha as a novice. He plunged into religious training and by the age of 16 had reached a deep understanding of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, approaching the state of an arahant, one free from all cravings and no longer subject to rebirth. When Daba received the perfect precepts of the fully ordained monk at the age of 20, he made a decision. He felt fortunate to have heard the Buddha's teaching and to have studied the profound truth of the Dharma while still young. But to enter fully into the realm of truth and completely destroy the illusion of self, he decided to undertake further severe discipline. He would pay reverence to all the monks and perform the various tasks necessary to the daily life of the Sangha. This would be his religious practice. After Daba received the Buddha's approval of his plan, he renewed his resolve to serve the other monks without selfishness or partiality. In preparing the monks' rooms, he spared no effort to see that their days of meditation were undisturbed. He allocated the rooms so that monks who practiced the formal recitation of the teaching could all be together, and the same for those who devoted themselves to keeping the precepts with special strictness, and for those who made preaching the Dharma their personal practice. He made sure that every monk's needs were seen to. There were rooms set aside for those who were physically weak, and there was appropriate bedding for the elderly. If a wandering monk appeared at the monastery late at night, Daba would leave his bed and carefully show the newcomer where things were: bedding, pillows, water for drinking and for washing, and so on. Thus, he devoted himself completely to the service of the monastic Sangha. The most difficult task of all was the fair division of food among the monks. Daba made a point of remembering which of the monks needed more food and which needed less when he distributed the food offered by pious laypeople or collected by the monks during their daily begging rounds. One day, a monk named Laludaya approached Daba as he distributed the food and challenged him. "What gives you the right to be the only one to divide up our food? Lately, I've been getting nothing but scraps. You're unfair. I'll do the dividing up from now on." When the Sangha agreed to Laludaya's demand, Daba was crushed. He felt that the others did not appreciate his efforts to distribute the food fairly. Laludaya was a member of the Sangha and was supposed to have abandoned worldly desires and pleasures, yet he had complained loudly about unfairness, comparing his portion with his neighbors. Daba wondered why Laludaya had entered the religious life in the first place. Two or three days after Laludaya had begun to divide up the food, the situation was clearly out of hand. The monks quickly realized how truly fair Daba's method of division had been, and Daba renewed his resolve, thinking, It is precisely because this kind of work is disagreeable and goes unappreciated that it can serve as an excellent practice for me. The other monks soon asked him deferentially to return to his former duties. Some years passed, and one day a wealthy lay believer from Rajagriha visited the Bamboo Grove Monastery. Listening to Daba's preaching, he was moved to say, "Your words have aroused in me a deep desire to acquire merit so as to be reborn in heaven. I hope some of the members of the Venerable Sangha will honor me by coming to my home tomorrow to receive the offerings of food that I shall prepare." After Daba had accepted his invitation, the lay believer asked which of the monks would be sent to his house. When he was told that Metiya and Bhumijaka would go, his face fell. These two monks, who were brothers, were infamous for their rudeness and arrogance, a reputation that had spread even among the laity. But a lay believer is not permitted to choose the monks to whom he would make offerings, so he could only acquiesce. When he returned home, the layman angrily gave orders to his maidservant, "We are going to have to make offerings to those worthless monks Metiya and Bhumijaka. When they arrive tomorrow, show them to the granary and give them the worst food we have." Metiya and Bhumijaka had no idea of the cold welcome awaiting them, of course. They were so overjoyed at the thought of the wonderful cuisine the rich man would be preparing for them that they were up at the crack of dawn with their robes and bowls in readiness. And off they went to the layman's mansion in Rajagriha. To their surprise, a mere maidservant greeted them. And when they were led to the gloomy granary and saw the coarse food that was set before them, they became angry, saying they had come at the invitation of the master of the house and demanding to know where he was. "The master is away on urgent business, but he left instructions for me to entertain you, reverend sirs," said the maidservant. "To entertain us?" asked Metiya. "In this granary, with this kind of food?" "Yes, sir. It is all just as the master ordered." "Idiot. He thinks we are going to accept these offerings," Metiya shouted angrily, kicking over the low tables set before them. Metiya and Bhumijaka left hurriedly for the Bamboo Grove Monastery. Metiya, who was literally trembling with rage, said, "This is all Daba's doing. We stood up to him, and so to pay us back, he devised this scheme to shame us by getting the layman to issue a bogus invitation." Just then, a nun happened by, and Metiya hit upon a plan. Putting on a smile, he addressed the nun politely, "Reverend sister, you know the senior monk Daba? He has the appearance of virtue, but in fact constantly insults and mistreats the two of us out of spite. Today, for example, he and a lay believer conspired to bring great shame on my brother and me. But there is a limit even to our patience. We have to do something. Don't you agree?" "Indeed, it is very wrong of Daba to do such things." "Yes, and to continue to allow such a biased man to be part of the Sangha is to bring shame on us all. So we would like you, Reverend Sister, to go to the Buddha and tell him that Daba has made improper advances to you and thus broken the precept against sexual misconduct. This is necessary to preserve the purity of the Sangha." The simple nun agreed, and presenting herself before the Buddha, repeated what she had been told to say. Then the Buddha summoned Daba before the assembled members of the Sangha and questioned him. "Daba, you have been accused of breaking the precept against sexual misconduct. Have you ever done such a thing?" Daba looked steadily at the Buddha and replied, The world-honored one knows far better than anyone else whether I would break such a precept." But the Buddha repeated his question, "Daba, have you ever broken the precept against sexual misconduct?" "World-honored one, it is as you know to be," Daba replied. Inwardly, he was deeply hurt, thinking, "Does the Buddha really believe the words of Metiya and Bhumijaka? Does he think me the kind of monk who would engage in immorality? Have all my efforts in religious practice gone unnoticed? Were they all in vain?" Daba was aroused from his thoughts by the Buddha's strong, insistent voice. "Daba, You must state clearly before the Sangha whether or not you have broken the precept against immorality. At that moment, Dabba experienced a kind of awakening. His self-concern, his need to defend himself, this was precisely the greatest obstacle to full liberation. World honored one, this accusation is baseless. As he spoke, he felt as if dark clouds were lifting from his heart. Dabba's statement was accepted as true by the Buddha and the Sangha. Then, Mattiya and Bhumijako were called forward. They could hide nothing from the Buddha's penetrating insight, and thus Dabba's name was cleared. This experience taught Dabba to see things in a new light. Until then, he had always secretly hoped that the other members of the Sangha would show appreciation for his hard work at such lowly tasks. But this attitude itself was a kind of selfish attachment. And the more effort he made to serve the monks, the stronger this particular attachment grew. To destroy it, he decided to devote himself with even greater energy and purity of intention to serving the Sangha. Soon it began to be rumored that a radiance could be seen flowing from Dabba's fingertips as he guided visiting monks about the monastery at night. There were even some monks who made a point of visiting the monastery after dark in order to observe the mysterious light. Dabba would guide them cheerfully walking through the dark monastery grounds without hesitation. And indeed, the monks following him could see his fingertips glowing with a strange radiance. Thus, Dabba Malaputta, by devoting himself totally to serving the Sangha, received the veneration and gratitude of all his fellow monks and was able to attain enlightenment of a high order. So, when we engage in practice, we all have come across the saying, practices, the orientation of our practice is to do something about ourselves, or to do something about the greed, hate, and delusion that arises in our own minds. And as we go along in our practice, it's really important to trust that the law of karma will be showing us how to do that, and to maturely accept that at times we will make mistakes. We will act out of a misunderstanding of the true nature of things, a misunderstanding of how things truly are. And to cultivate the kind of trusting attitude that I'm talking about is to accept that that situation is true, that because we don't see things clearly, we will make mistakes, and we will receive the consequences of those mistakes. So an example of not doing that are the two monks, Mattiya and Bhumijaka. Clearly they had been behaving in ways that were not exemplary, and created a reputation for themselves because of that, which even, as it says in the story, even the laity knew about. And as a consequence of their wrong actions, they were treated poorly by the lay people who were supporting the Sangha. And in contrast to the attitude that I'm talking about, became angry and resisted acceptance of the consequences of their own actions. So they kick over the food and storm out of the house and plot to, upset Dabba. So this is the kind of reaction to the arising of karmic consequence that we want to be careful not to allow to get out of hand with us. It's not, we're human beings and we get upset. We get angry and all that kind of thing. We want to be really careful to train that, to look at it and say, what is really going on here? What's really at the root of my anger? What's really at the root of my upsetness? And that's what Dabba really exemplified in this particular story. The simple nun, accused him of sexual misconduct. And the Buddha said, well, okay, Dabba, you've been accused of this. What is the deal here? And hurt and ill will kind of arises in his heart, and he's kind of thinking, God, you know, I'm better than this. The Buddha knows that I didn't do this. And truthfully, he didn't do that. So, you know, there's some justification in there. But what there is also is the sense of hurt feelings, the sense of upsetness. And what he points out to us is how to train with that. Trusting, oh, this isn't just arising out of randomness. The situation isn't really just arising because the world is mean, or because the Buddha is mean, or because these people are mean. But there's a reason for this to arise. Trusting in that situation, trusting in that kind of reality of life, and looking more deeply into his own heart. Well, what is really going on here? Why am I upset? What's the teaching in this for me? What can I learn from this? And in this sense, he's exemplifying this kind of trust that I'm talking about. He's trusting the world is not just a place of random events. The world is not just a place where kind of bad things happen to good people because it's random and that's the way it is. There is truth in the matter that all things arise according to causes and conditions. And that when hurt arises in us, when we receive the consequences of negative past actions, it will be suffering. When suffering arises in us, there is a reason for it. There is a reason for suffering to arise in our hearts. And to cultivate, I'm not saying that we should kind of automatically become, you know, kind of perfectly trusting in this, but to cultivate that recollection, oh, there is a reason for things to arise. There is a reason for my suffering to arise. Let me look more deeply into my own reactions. Let me look more deeply into what's going on in my own heart, what's really going on here. And again, Daba to me, a great example of that. Oh, I see. Even though I'm doing this really good job for the Sangha, even though I'm doing this beneficial thing, even though I'm living morally purely, I am allowing a little bit of attachment to get in there. I'm thinking, what a great guy am I? Shouldn't the Sangha really be quite appreciative of me? you know, what? Gee, I'm neat. Which may be true. There might be some truth in it. But you can see how it becomes a self and attached. And so he then realized, oh, I need to let go of that too. And to really redouble my efforts to train. I mean, how often... I've seen myself in this situation before, you know, how often I've done some good job and I think, and people don't really kind of appreciate it well enough, and I think to myself, well, enough of that. I'm done with them. I'm out of here. storm off. Adaba's kind of thinking, no, I actually need to try harder at my job. I need to do a little bit better at what I'm doing. And really try to get underneath that impulse to self-aggrandizement. And again, so the point that I really want to emphasize is that we can also cultivate that trusting attitude. We can cultivate that attitude which is saying, okay, here I am in the world, and the Buddha taught that we all are going to receive the consequences of our former actions. And if they're negative actions, then we're going to receive negative consequences. If they're positive actions, then we're going to receive positive consequences. Most of us are receiving a mixture of both things. Actually, most of us are receiving more positive consequences than we're receiving negative consequences. I mean, just by being human beings and able to drive a car to the temple implies quite a good amount of good karma, which isn't to minimize the suffering that we might feel, but to just remind us that we're actually in a fairly good situation. But to continue to kind of pull in that thread, I think River Master Ji had this great analogy for training as being like standing next to a garbage can in which there's a kind of bunch of yarn that you want, and kind of pulling in the yarn and rolling it into a ball. And as you pull it in, you're kind of cleaning off the junk that's gotten stuck to the yarn. And you kind of pull it in and clean it off, and pull it in and clean it off. And in a way, that really kind of symbolizes what training is like, where we're just kind of constantly rolling in our ball of yarn and cleaning it off and rolling it in and cleaning it off. And all throughout our training, however far we go, we will continue to have things to clean off our ball of yarn. They may get more and more subtle over time, and we need to be alert to that. There's never a time when we can kind of go into autopilot in training, where we can just kind of say, oh, okay, everything's kind of done. I don't need to think about it anymore. We always need to kind of continue to engage with it and work on it. And continue to trust, however far along we go, there will be karmic consequence, and we need to look at that and see, why is this affecting me? Why is this arising? Why is this causing suffering? That was what I wanted to say. Hopefully it made a little bit of sense. Any questions or thoughts? Yes?
Is every bad thing that happens karma? Or there may be just, you know, like in this world that we live, there is a tendency for things to go wrong. So should we think it is karma, or maybe it's just the way things work with the laws and everything that happens in this?
Yeah, the way I look at that is that there's a whole bunch of different factors going on. There's a law of, you know, scientific laws, there's laws of karma, there's laws of all kinds of different things. And they all kind of intertwine. You can kind of understand it as being, it is your karmic consequence to be reborn in this kind of world. I mean, there was a great story when there was a big tsunami in Indonesia a number of years ago. And there was a kind of group of religious leaders met together, and the Abrahamic people are kind of saying, this is God's will. And there's a Buddhist monk there, and he says, well, this is just a world in which that kind of thing happens. I mean, we live in a world in which literally the ground is floating on molten rock. I mean, it's bound to happen sometime that it's going to move in a way that we don't like it. And so there's that level of things. It's our karma to be reborn into a world in which things like that happen. The critical thing that I was taught to look for is what, in terms of karma, is what arises in our feeling with regard to things like this. If you're in an earthquake and, you know, it's a disaster, people are getting killed left and right and all that stuff, and you are sitting still within that and have a serene heart, there is no reason to believe that that earthquake arises because of your karma. There is actually no reason to believe that the earthquake arises because of anybody's karma. But if you're in that earthquake and the disaster's happening, people are dying left and right, and you're all upset, and you're grieving and wailing and angry, then, from the point of view of practice, we need to look at your own mind and say, oh, okay, well, why is this upsetting me? Why am I angry? Why do I have grief arising? What is going on here? And in that sense, the earthquake is a sort of vehicle for your karma to arise, those feelings to arise. And we can say, oh, because of this earthquake, I'm able to see these karmic reactions. You know, you might have been going along and thinking, oh, I'm all serene and nice and I don't get upset. But then an earthquake comes and, you know, kind of causes your house to collapse and your family to be killed. And then you get all upset. You think, oh, wake up call. Here I am. Maybe there was more attachment there than I had realized. Maybe there was more of X, Y, or Z there than I realized. And I can now look at that and see. If you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, and basically, it's like, I'm trying to understand karma, but I also see that, for example, seeing somebody close to you die is something that is really, we can call it bad for you, you don't feel happy. But it's a natural thing. I mean, this body is not immortal, so that's going to happen, not only to one, but to all of us at some point. So it's like, just accept the things the way they are and see it as, you know, that person is not there anymore. And of course, accept what comes out of the situation. If tears come out, well, just accept that too.
Yeah, what is really kind of important to remember is that we have those words that we can say. We have that teaching that we can give ourselves. And to realize that in the process of it, there's something else more that we can do. As someone dies, we can tell ourselves, this is the natural course of events. This is the natural state of things. And I need to accept that. From the point of view of training, that's an excellent first step. But the point that we can go to beyond that is to apply meditation in the situation and see why we aren't accepting it, if we're not. And to learn how to come to be able to accept it, if we can't. Do you see what I'm getting at? So in other words, someone passes away, we get upset, we're grieving, and we recognize in our own heart, as we're kind of meditating with it, as we're looking, I'm not accepting this. Even though the reality of it is, I just have to, because it's reality, it's life. But I'm not. So then, in terms of training, we can sit still in that and say, why is that? What is going on here? Where am I in my own heart and mind holding on to something that I can train myself to let go of? And so in that sense, we can take that teaching that you have nicely and eloquently stated and turn it into a practice within our own heart and mind.
You had a question before the story.
I wanted to make sure I knew the name of that book.
It's called The Disciples of the Buddha. And it lives on the shelf there. Okay. It's edited by Zeno Ishigami.
And I think that my only question or comment is, sometimes when things arise, I'm just left with confusion. There is no clarity. And that seems to be the norm for me. I don't understand. I'm confused. I can't pinpoint it. And that's frustrating. Any words of wisdom there when that's usually like part of the habit?
Yeah. Confusion is a consequence of something. And so to be able to sit still within the arising of confusion and to say, what is really going on here? And to cultivate the willingness to see what is really going on. Because sometimes confusion arises out of an unwillingness to see clearly what is going on. If, for instance, like for myself, if I really want something to be a certain way, or want someone to be with me, or want something to happen in a certain way, and it's not that way, I can take and distort my mind in such a way as to not see that clearly. And that creates a kind of confusion. But being willing, cultivating the willingness to just see clearly what I'm holding on to, what I'm pushing away, helps with the process of understanding confusion or clarifying confusion. So it's really a matter of continuing to be willing to sit with a thing and the determination, in a sense, to just see clearly what your real motivation is. and to just sit. It's like that analogy, meditation's kind of described as an analogy of having a beaker of water, muddy water, it's all stirred up, and not being able to see clearly. And in terms of meditation, we're just going to sit still until the water, and to hold still until the water, the murkiness in the water settles to the bottom, and then we can see more clearly what's going on. So it's really just that continuous effort to just continue to sit still and allow things to settle down and be determined to see what's going on. Maybe Master Rokuzan has.
I know for myself, for me, the first step in with confusion is simply to accept it, is simply to stop demanding clarity, to simply to think that a mind that's somehow in control is very important. There's some compassion that needs to arise there with that. And that goes a long way for me to dealing with that. And as Reverend Leon was saying, confusion can be a karmic habit. You know, it may be something that we have used in the past to protect ourselves from seeing clearly some things about ourselves or about our environment that we don't like. And so just sitting still within that. You know, and like, as he was saying again, asking, you know, for help here. You know, what is it I need to see? What am I avoiding seeing? Without banging on the self, saying, you know, you must see, you know, this must be clear. It all takes patience. But if confusion, as you suggested, is a regular for you, then it's something you need to become a little more friendly with, or at least more accepting of, more compassionate with. That's been my experience anyway. And recognize that it's just, you know, a way that a particular karmic stream tries to deal with the world, or at least that may be some aspect of it. And that's okay. And we need to be willing to sit still and let that murkiness subside. And it may take a while. You know, we may never have the kind of bear trap mind or whatever that we would like to have.
That's bacon slicer mind.
I beg your pardon?
Bacon slicer mind.
I hadn't heard that one, but yeah.
Somebody anyway. Describes Miss Marple as having a mind like a bacon slicer.
I just, you know, I think for myself I'll never have that kind of mind, and that's always been for me something that I longed for. You know, and that was part of the potentially the difficulty there, and just recognizing, okay, you know, maybe this lifetime that's just not in the card. Maybe it is eventually, I don't know. But that's also part of that compassion and being willing to sit still with whatever is arising. And the fact that you're recognizing habits, the fact that you're recognizing things that seem to come up on a regular basis is excellent. Because that's the way we begin to see what we need to deal with.
I think it's one of the great things, the underappreciated things about meditation practice that we just don't quite recognize is that we're really cultivating a different way of being, a different way of relating to our minds and our and the world. It's like, you know, we kind of grow up, we get educated, we get our jobs and all that stuff, and we use a particular faculty of mind, our thinking minds or, you know, whatever it is that we use. And we think, we kind of have the view that that's all that there is. But in terms of what we're learning in meditation, is we're actually kind of bringing to bear a whole nother part of our being. we're bringing to bear and cultivating a whole nother, the whole kind of basement, the whole kind of foundation of our mind. And we just don't recognize that that is actually much bigger than the functioning of our kind of analytical mind. Our sense of meditation, our the potential of meditation is enormous, is enormously bigger than just our analytical faculty of mind. And we should kind of, I mean, in a way it's, it, we should just kind of bear that in mind. We can't really make too much of it, because it's a bit like a wild animal that if you, the more you kind of pursue, the more it kind of runs away. But the more we meditate, the more we actually apply meditation, the more we allow that to kind of come forth and to be inform our way of doing things. In other words, by allowing ourselves to be different and think differently, we enable some other sense. Like, I have this feeling of sometimes being confused, like with my allergies. Here's the thing. With my allergies, sometimes I have kind of no frontal lobe activity in my mind going on at all. It's just kind of this white blah. Like, there's just nothing going on up there. But I can still function. I can still do work. I could, like, you know, when I was a baker, I could still do my job. I could still deal with people. I can talk and all this stuff. But there's just nothing going on in my mind at all. And I recognize that as a function of, in a sense, of meditation. Like, there's just so much else going on that is happening in a place that's just not my brain. And the more we just begin to trust in that and rely on meditation, the more that informs our decisions. And in a sense, then, our choices begin to change in that direction. How we kind of intuitively feel about making choices changes, and that affects the consequences of our actions. Does that make some sense?
Mm-hmm.
Just by being kind of willing to be different and being willing to allow meditation to kind of take more of a fore in our life, it does so, and we may not actually see that overtly or be aware of it, but it really does happen.
And sometimes for me that confusion is simply that lack of anything going on. Well, I have these expectations of the way I should be thinking and dealing with the world, and it may simply be that there's not a problem, it's just not the way I would like it to be. It's not as if it's something awful or that I'm not training or turning away from training or something. It's just less analytical mind than I might like. So it we need to be careful about judging what's going on. And yes, if we do see a regular habit, then use that information and work with it. And also be willing to cut ourselves a little slack and say, you know, maybe this isn't quite what it appears to be. You know, I need to be careful about judging this here, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm.